the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
I will sing for the one I love, a song about his vineyard. My loved one had a vineyard on a fertile hillside. He dug it up and cleared it of stones and planted it with the choicest vines. He built a watchtower in it and cut out a winepress as well. Then he looked for a crop of good grapes, but it yielded only bad fruit. Now you dwellers in Jerusalem and people of Judah, judge me and my vineyard. What more could have been done for my vineyard that I have done for it? When I looked for good grapes, why did it yield only bad? Now I will tell you what I'm going to do with my vineyard. I will take it away its hedge, and it will be destroyed. I will break down its wall, and it will be trampled. I will make it a wasteland, neither pruned nor cultivated, and briars and thorns will grow there. I will command the clouds not to rain on it. The vineyard of the Lord Almighty is the house of Israel, and the people of Judah are the vines he delighted in. And he looked for justice, but saw bloodshed, for righteousness, but heard cries of distress. Woe to you who add house to house and join field to field till no space is left, and you live alone in the land. The Lord Almighty had declared in my hearing, surely their great houses will become desolate, the fine mansions left without occupants. A 10-acre vineyard will produce only a bath of wine, a homer of seed, only an apher of grain. Woe to those who rise early in the morning to run after their drinks, who stay up late at night till they are inflamed with wine. They have harps and lyres at their banquets, pipes and tambourines and wine, but they have no regard for the deeds of the Lord, no respect for the work of his hands. Therefore my people will go into exile for the lack of understanding. Those of high rank will die of hunger, and the common people will be parched with thirst. Therefore the grave enlarges its appetite and opens wide its mouth. Into it will descend their nobles and masses, with all their brawlers and revellers. So people will be brought low and everyone humbled, the eyes of the arrogant humbled. But the Lord Almighty will be exalted by his justice, and the holy God will be proved holy by his righteous acts. Then sheep will graze as in their own pastures, lambs will feed among the ruins of the rich. Woe to those who draw sin along with the cords of deceit, and wickedness as with cart ropes, to those who say, let God hurry, let him hasten his work, so that we may see it. The plan of the Holy One of Israel, let it approach, let it come into view, so that we may know it. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. Woe to those who are heroes at drinking wine and champions at mixing drinks, who acquit the guilty for a bribe but deny justice to the innocent. Therefore, as tongues of fire lick up straw and a dry grass sinks down in the flames, so their roots will decay and their flowers blow away like dust. For they have rejected the law of the Lord Almighty and spurned the word of the Holy One of Israel. Therefore the Lord's anger burns against his people. His hand is raised and he strikes them down. The mountains shake and the dead bodies are like refuse in the streets. Yet for all this, his anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised. He lifts up a banner for the distant nations. He whistles for those at the ends of the earth. Here they come, swiftly and speedily. Not one of them grows tired or stumbles. Not one slumbers or sleeps. Not a belt is loosened at the waist. Not a sandal thong is broken. Their arrows are sharp, all their bows are strung. Their horses' hooves seem like flint, their chariot wheels like a whirlwind. Their roar is like that of a lion. They roar like the young lions. They growl as they seize their prey and carry it off with no one to rescue. In that day, they will roar over it like the roaring of the sea. And if one looks at the land, there is only darkness and distress. Even the sun will be darkened by the clouds.
Okay, we're going to look today at the chapter we've just heard read from Isaiah chapter 5. We're on the way through Isaiah chapters 1 to 12, and this is an important chapter in the sequence. Let me start by telling you a story that I heard quite a bit, something like 20 years ago. It seemed like every youth evangelist in the country was telling it then, but it's fallen into disrepair, so maybe there's somebody here who hasn't heard it yet. I'm not sure who it applies to either, because I've heard many people say, oh, this happened to me, and they can't all be right, or to a friend of mine, and I don't know who the friend is, so let me tell it as if it's happening to you. You're in a railway station. You're about to catch a train, but you have a little while on the platform before your train goes, so you go into the station cafe and get yourself a cup of coffee. You buy one of those little cellophane wrap packs of four biscuits that you can buy in places like that, and you search around for somewhere to sit. There's only one table. It's got a spare place at it. It's one of these little tiny tables for two people, and there's somebody already there, but there's a spare seat. So you introduce yourself and say hello and sit down and put on the table your bag and your cup of coffee and your little pack of cellophane-wrapped biscuits. And you take a swig of the coffee. Then to your surprise, the other person, who had seemed straight, regular person, reaches forward, picks up your little pack of biscuits, opens it, and eats one. And you're speechless. I mean, this just does not happen. You hadn't invited him, you hadn't had any yourself. And so you grab a biscuit and shove it into your mouth, trying to exude as much displeasure as you possibly can as you do so. And he doesn't say anything, he just, well, he looks slightly bemused, I suppose. But, you go on drinking your coffee in silence. And then, to your absolute amazement, there are two biscuits left, and he reaches out his hand and takes another one and eats it. You cannot believe what you are seeing. So immediately you reach out, grab the last biscuit, shove it in your mouth, screw up the cellophane, throw it in the bin, and get ready to leave. You slurp down your coffee. You pick up your bag, and underneath it, there is another little pack of biscuits, which is your pack of biscuits, which you hadn't noticed you put there. Embarrassing. Easily happens, doesn't it? You think you understand what's going on, and you don't. And you suddenly feel very guilty, because you realise that reality is actually quite different from what you expected. Now, there are many points in the Bible where this happens. You know, where people suddenly realise that reality is not quite the way they thought it is until then, and they are guilty in some way that they didn't think. I mean, think of David, whom we were thinking about, some of us at New Key last week. He commits adultery with somebody else's wife. He even has the husband constructively sent into the front line of the army so he will die. And he thinks he's got away with it. And one day a prophet is telling him a story. And it's a story about somebody who takes a poor man's one lamb. And David is outraged and he says, "This is dreadful, we've got to do something about this." And the prophet looks at him and says, "You're the man. That's what you've been doing. For lamb, read wife. And otherwise it's you." And suddenly he realizes what's happening. Or think of the Apostle Paul on his way to Damascus. You know, full of zeal, persecuting Christians, thinking he's doing the will of God, thinking that he sees reality the way it is. And all of a sudden, bright light, voice speaking out of it, "Saul, why are you persecuting me?" And he begins to realize this is the Lord of glory talking, and he's identical with Jesus whom he's persecuting. Suddenly, his take on reality goes through a big shift. Or think of Balaam in the Old Testament, the guy who is a prophet and he's going for hire to prophesy against the Israelites, and he's expecting a fat check at the end of the operation, but his donkey won't cooperate, and his donkey won't go in the way he's supposed to go. He keeps on turning to one side or another, and Balaam starts beating the donkey, and the donkey turns around and talks to him, which should have been an indication there was something strange going on. He says, "What are you doing this for?" And Balaam has an argument with the donkey, and then the Lord opens Balaam's eyes. And he suddenly sees an angel standing there in the roadway with a sword. And the donkey had seen it all along. Balaam hadn't. And he begins to realize reality is a little bit different from what he thought it was. Well, now, this is what's happening, it seems to me, in Isaiah chapters 1 to 5. Right at the start of this series, when Derek was talking about chapter 1, he mentioned a commentary by a man called Ray Ortland. And Ortland, he said one thing that's quite important about Isaiah. Isaiah's call from God was to present a God-centered way of seeing and living that offers everyone the true alternative to the false appearances of the world. In other words, Isaiah is saying, look, you see reality one way. God actually sees it quite another way. You think that God and you are best buddies. You think he's quite happy with you. Actually, he's not. You think you're safe and secure. Actually, you're facing doom and disaster because your whole way of thinking, your priorities, your aims in life are so askew. And so he's calling them desperately back to a different way of seeing things. We'll see next week where he got this new perspective from, but that's for chapter 6. Let's just look at where we've been so far. Chapter 1 talks about the problem. The way in which you need to see God, see yourself, and see God's plans for the world. It's different, says Isaiah, from the way that you see things at the moment. Chapter 2 looks into the far distant future and talks about what God is planning. The whole of the world is going to be blessed through his people. That is, if they play their part properly. But they're not doing it. And so God has this wonderful worldwide vision, bringing the whole earth together. And Israel are just not playing ball. They're not doing what they should be. As a result, he goes on in chapters 3 and 4 to say, this is what it's going to mean for you people. And it's going to be terrible. They will have to be judged. They will have to be refined. They'll have to be sorted out. And chapter 3 talks about that. But the purpose of this judgment is not just God losing his temper and putting the boot in. It's restorative. It's to bring them back. It's to refine them and make them more fit for their purpose. And so now we reach chapter 5, where Isaiah, having spoken about what God is doing and what God is planning, now fills them in on why God is doing it. Why does he feel this way about his people? If you just look at God's inner emotions, what is going on there? And it's on that basis, we'll see next week, that Isaiah can talk about his own experience of God and where that all started from and why he hears this voice in his ears that it seems nobody else in Israel hears, speaking a very different message from the other prophets who are around. So, chapter 5 is about seeing things from God's point of view, and it starts with a song about a vineyard. Now, we've often spoken in looking at Isaiah about chiasms. Do you remember what a chiasm is? It's one of those mirror image kind of structures which they use to bind poems together in the way that we use rhyme. You know, the Hebrews didn't do that much. We tend to make the ends of lines sound the same as one another. I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high o'er vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils, 10,000 saw I at a glance, tossing their heads in sprightly dance. And that's a traditional way of binding poetry together. Mind you, the people that write worship songs these days seem to have forgotten about that, but we won't go into that this morning. Okay, but they use chiastic structures in Israel instead. And here, if you look at this little poem, you see that it starts and finishes with a bit about the vineyard. It starts off, I will sing for the one I love a song about his vineyard on the fertile hillside. And in verse 7, at the end of it, it tells you what the vineyard is. The vineyard of the Lord Almighty is the house of Israel. And those are the bookends of the poem, if you like, start and finish talking about the vineyard. Then when you move further in, you find a bit about the work that God is doing. At the start, the work he's done is to get the vineyard ready. He dug it up and cleared it of stones and planted it with the choicest vines. I'm told that to get a vineyard like this ready would take 3 years of back-breaking work before you saw any grapes. So this is hard work that's being talked about. But at the end of the poem, in verses 5 and 6, you see God undoing the work he's done already. I'll break down the wall. It'll be trampled. I'll make it a wasteland. Briars and thorns will grow there. And so those two themes balance one another as well. Then there are references to the crop. In 2b, then he looked for a crop of good grapes, but it yielded only bad fruit, or the word really means stinking fruit. And in 4b, the other side of the divide, what more could I have done for my vineyard? When I looked for good grapes, why did it yield only bad? And that balancing means that the thing that's in the middle is the heart of the whole poem. This is what it's really about. And so the final message of the poem is the middle of the chiasm, which is the complaint in verses 3 and 4a. Now, you dwellers in Jerusalem and people of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more could have been done for my vineyard than I have done for it? That's the point of the poem. Isaiah is saying, listen, see things the way God sees them, and you will see that you are hurting him. You're causing him pain. God is not like the gods of the nations round about, just a force of nature, like electricity or the wind. He's not somebody predictable. He's not somebody uncaring. He's somebody who loves you and cares for you, and you are capable, because he loves you, of doing him enormous harm. And so I think the first thing that Isaiah is saying here, I must stop picking up the wrong clicker, there we go, is that you may be hurting your God more than you imagine. And that's an important lesson for us to think about. Every time we go away from him, every time we live in a way we're not supposed to, every time we rationalize and compromise our faith and justify ourselves for doing things that we know are wrong, and we do it again and again, every time we do that, we're hurting him. And maybe if we just realized that, we wouldn't be such bad servants of his, such bad fruit-producing vineyards. The thing is, it's easy to play the game, to look like everybody else, to look as if you're living a life of consecrated, radical Christian discipleship, when actually, he knows and you know, your heart is a million miles away from where it should be. You can look very like the real thing. See, there's a bit of wordplay goes on in this section that you don't see in English. It says in verse 7, he looked for justice but saw bloodshed, for righteousness but heard cries of distress. Well, the word for justice is mishpat. The word for bloodshed is mishpach. Not very different. Very different in meaning, but they sound pretty much the same. For righteousness, the word is sedaka. For cries of distress, it's se'aka. Almost the same thing. And you can be so close in the way you look outwardly to what God wants, and yet your heart can be a million miles away. What's God looking for? He's looking for justice. He's looking for righteousness. And the word that Isaiah uses means social righteousness, righteousness between people. A large part of God's assessment of your Christianity will be based on how you treat other people. If you think about the Ten Commandments, you can see that, can't you? The first four commandments are all about God and our relationship to God. The next six are all about others. Don't murder them. Don't sleep with somebody else's wife. Don't bear false witness. Don't covet what somebody else has. All of them, things which most of the tribes around there would say, this has got nothing to do with the gods. What's this stuff doing in a code between God and human beings? But for the God of Israel, it's desperately important. Because real relationships, an absence of bloodshed and grasping and greed and competitiveness in our society is what he's looking for. He's looking for harmony. He's looking for peace. He's looking for Sheol. He's looking for people who will love one another unfeignedly and help to build up one another's lives. And if we're not doing that, we're not producing the grapes. And you can hurt your God more than you imagine. And he's not just our self-indulgent Santa Claus buddy in the sky. He's somebody who burns for us to live in the way he created us to live, to walk in his ways, to live properly. And when we don't, we may be hurting him more than we imagine. But then, having done the little poem bit, he moves on to something else. And in the middle section of the chapter, you find six different situations where Isaiah says, woe. Doom is coming upon you because of something or other. And he picks out six ways in which people can lose their way. I think the message that goes through this bit is that you may be losing your way more than you imagine to. And many people have pointed out that these six things that he analyses actually form a sequence. It's not, you know, you can lose it this way or that way or that way or that way, you know, lots of different ways of losing it. It's that one tends to lead on to another. It's as if there are six steps taking you further and further and further away, out of tune with God, less and less able to understand what he's going on about. Six steps. Let's just have a look at them. The first woe is in verse 8. Can you see it? Woe to you who add house to house and join field to field till no space is left and you live alone in the land. Isaiah wheels round on those who've been becoming wealthy at everybody else's expense. They've been buying up fields, they've been building their estates, building the houses so close together there's no room between them, that's what the Hebrew means, and pushing people out of this land which now belongs to them. Now, this was never supposed to happen in Israel. According to Moses' law, the land belonged to tribes and families in perpetuity. And although you could buy and sell land for 50 years, in that 50th year, everything went right back to its original owner. And in that way, nobody became wealthy and nobody became poor. But that had been forgotten about. And now people were just becoming property magnates, buying up whatever they could, being as shrewd as they could, and pushing people out. And where before you'd had community, you'd had people living in villages, now there was just rolling wasteland where people were building their estates. And God says, well, if that's what you want, loneliness and seclusion, that's what you'll get. The entire land is going to be desolate. Surely the great houses will become desolate, the fine mansions left without occupants. Because you'll all be taken off into captivity. Then you'll get the loneliness that you're looking for. And it's so easy just to want what we can get for ourselves, to build our lives up around our possessions, our comfort, what we can do for us. And when that starts taking over from what does God want me to do? What has he put me in this world for? How will I invest the remaining decades of my life in serving him? Then we've taken the first step away. What's the second step? Well, that's verse 11. Woe to those who rise early in the morning to run after the drinks and then stay up late at night till they are inflamed with wine. Drink all day long. What's this about? Well, it's about when you start saying, we've got what we want, we've got the basis of security, we've got the possessions, our life is nice. Now let's just enjoy ourselves. We want more and more enjoyment out of life. And life becomes built on that basis. And we forget that there are more serious issues. They have harps and lyres at the banquets, pipes and tambourines and wine, but they have no regard for the deeds of the Lord, no respect for the work of his hands. They never ask themselves, what does God want me to do with my life? What am I here for? If I belong to him, what does he want from me as a result of his grace and his giving towards me? And that's the second step. The third step is the one that you find in verse 18. Woe to those who draw sin along with cords of deceit and wickedness as with cart ropes. What's this talking about? Well, it's saying that if you want to, you can live life in a sinful way, but you won't enjoy it. It's as if sin is this kind of heavy object that if you want to drag into the center of your life, you have to haul along on a cart with ropes. And you have to manhandle it into place. It's not an easy thing to do. What's Isaiah saying? Basically, that God has given us a way of living which is right. And if you try and live in any other way, you're going to make a mess of it. You're going to make life artificially hard for yourself. I mean, you talk to anybody who has had an affair outside marriage. Ask them what it's like. And I've heard it again and again from people in that situation. It is sheer hard work. It's great when it starts, you know, the secrecy and somebody there thinks you're wonderful and you have all these clandestine meetings and little dinners together and so on. But then you have to stop your wife discovering your mobile phone. You have to obliterate text messages. You have to make excuses for the times when you were late and you were somewhere else where you were supposed to be. And just living that life of deception becomes sheer hard work. We were not made to live lives of deception or lives of jealousy or hatred or greed. You remember that commandment in the Old Testament that says, honor your father and mother that your days may be long in the land. What's that saying? That if you're good to your mum and dad, you get to live forever? Not really. What it's saying is the converse of that, though. That if you don't live in that way, that if you build your life around unharmonious relationships, you are wearing away your mental energy. You're living life in a way you are never supposed to. And people who surround themselves with hostility and bitterness and tension are reducing their capacity to live a long and healthy life. God's ways make sense. He designed our system. And if you want to be wicked, you can be wicked. But it's not going to be that easy. Then the fourth woe is when you start losing all sense of bearings. You refuse to accept that what you're doing is wrong. You find a justification. Well, my marriage really ended quite a while ago. Well, the chemistry's gone between us. Well, I deserve a little bit of something or other for all the hard work I've... whatever it happens to be. You know the excuses. They're 10 a penny. And we start justifying what's wrong. Woe to those, says Isaiah, verse 20, who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. And the end result of that, it's accelerating now. The woes are getting shorter and shorter. Is number 5 follows quickly afterwards. We decide what's okay and what isn't. Woe to those, says verse 21, who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. You start calling the shots. You start deciding what's right. You start saying things like, how can it be all wrong when it feels so right? And you get in a moral no man's land where you're calling the shots, you're judging, and God's ideas go right out of the window. And the final thing, well, you end up in triviality. You lose any sense of what's important and valuable. Look at the sixth woe in verse 22. Woe to those, says Isaiah, who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. Woe to those who are heroes at drinking wine and champions at mixing drinks. And that's all you're good for. You can mix the perfect cocktail. And that's what you pride yourself on. Life has got to be about more than that. And Isaiah says, when you miss those important things, you acquit the guilty for a bribe, but you deny justice to the innocent. Other people suffer because of the way that you are focusing your life on the trivial, on the entertaining, on fripperies. And God has called you to be more than that. I once saw a sermon by John Piper. It's on YouTube if you want to search it out, where he talks about tragedy in life. And he's talking to an audience of young people, most of them students, and saying, you know, two missionaries, elderly ladies in my church, died in Africa last week. The brakes on their Land Rover gave way. They hurtled over a cliff and they were dead very quickly. And people are saying, what a tragedy. He said, don't call that a tragedy. They died after years of glorious service. They left a fantastic record behind them. They were taken into the presence of Jesus doing something they loved. They were not a tragedy. And he says, do you know, you want to hear what a tragedy is? I've got one right here. And he takes a clipping out. I think it's from Time magazine or some American newspaper. And it's about a couple who've taken early retirement. And the item about them says, Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so in future will devote most of their time to holidays in Florida and occasionally trips to the Caribbean and enlarging their massive collection of shells. And Piper says, that is a tragedy. What, shells? When you appear before the judgment seat of Christ, he says, what did you do with the life I gave you in the world? Did you feed the hungry? Did you stand up for the oppressed? Did you challenge injustice? Did you preach the gospel? Did you feed my sheep? Did you encourage other Christians to stand firm? Well, no, Lord, but I've got lots of shells here. It's not going to be great, is it? What are the achievements of our lives going to be like? Do we focus on the trivial, or do we focus on what's really important? So Isaiah wants to say all of that. And he wants to say, look, maybe it's time we looked at things a different way. You could be hurting your God more than you actually imagine. You could be losing your way more than you actually imagine. And the third thing, and the final thing he wants to say at the end of the chapter is this, you may be squandering your chances more than you imagine as well. Because you only get so much time to get it straight, to sort it out. And if you don't take those chances, then doom comes quickly. And so at the end of the chapter, there's a whole section where he talks from verse 26 onwards about the anger of the Lord that's coming upon his people. The captivity that will be a reality in just a few years. And he says, don't think you're going to escape it. Don't think the Assyrians and the Babylonians are peoples miles across the desert who couldn't be here tomorrow if God chose, because they could be. He lifts up a banner, verse 26, for the distant nations. He whistles for those at the end of the earth, and here they come swiftly and quickly. That word whistles, incidentally, is the sort of thing that a beekeeper apparently did when he wanted the bees to come out of the hive and go into the garden to the flowers, or wanted them to come out of the flowers and go back into the hive. There's a sort of hissing whistle that beekeepers used to use to get the bees to do what they wanted. And as if by magic, the bees would swarm out of the hive and swarm back in again. And Isaiah is saying it's just like that with God and the forces at work in this world. When he commands, they obey. And don't think you're going to escape. Not one of them grows tired or stumbles. Not a belt is loosened at the waist. Not a sandal thong is broken. They'll be here faster than you can think. Their horses' hooves seem like flint. Their chariot wheels like a whirlwind. Their roar is like that of the lion. If one looks at the land, there's only darkness and distress. And so he says, be careful. If you're going to sort yourself out, do it while you've still got time. I was once absolutely heartbroken when one of those church scandals broke a few years ago, because it concerned somebody I admired enormously. A man called Ted Haggard, who was the chair of the National Association of Evangelicals in America. He was somebody who'd paid his dues as a teenager by smuggling Bibles into Soviet Russia at the risk of his freedom and perhaps even of his life. He'd built a church which started with just himself and his wife and a few friends and became an absolutely massive mega church with a fantastic teaching ministry. Because of the wisdom of his counsel and his shrewdness, he'd been appointed to the chairmanship of the NAE, which is the premier body linking evangelical Christians together in America. He had the ear of the president. He was in and out of the White House all the time. And suddenly, a homosexual prostitute phoned up the papers and said, I can't stand this man's hypocrisy. I want you to know that although he says things about homosexuality, he's one of my clients. And what's more, I've supplied him with drugs on several occasions. And for a week, Haggard tried to deny it. But the evidence was overwhelming, and at the end of the week, he had to admit not only that he'd done those things, but also that he'd been lying for a whole week about his involvement. And so he lost his job and he left his church. And I remember going to the website of the church just after this story had broken, just to see what was going on there. And they still had up at that point, they took it down shortly afterwards, but they still had up the last sermon he had preached the Sunday before. And it was about Saul and David. And about how it's possible for somebody to be taken out of Christian ministry. It's possible for God to sideline somebody and remove authority from him simply because he's living in the wrong way, his heart is not right with God, and he's off in the wrong direction. And I listened to that, my mouth hanging open. Didn't he realize the implications of what he was saying? Was he preaching to himself, or what was going on here? And I'm sure that Haggard would have been thinking in the back of his mind, okay, I will sort it out, I will sort it out. I just need some weeks, I just need some months, I just need a little bit of time, and I will eventually get all of these things straight, but not now. And the time was much shorter than he thought he had. If we are going to live for God, we can't postpone it. We can't put it on the back burner. However much of a future you have, it starts here. And you could be squandering your chances more than you imagine if you put off the big decisions, if you put off sorting out the things that aren't quite right, if you put off the issue of where your heart is, what your motivation and your commitment is, much longer. That's what Isaiah is saying anyhow. We're going to sing another little bit to finish with, but before then, let's just pray for a second, shall we? And Joe, do come up and get ready, please, by all means. But let's just pray. And think about where that leaves us. This is a fairly somber message this morning, I'm afraid. But I preach it not to make us feel gloomy or distressed or anything like that, but because for us there is time. Because we can do something about whatever it is that God is hitting at in our tender consciences. And I just pray that as a result of this morning, we'll reorient ourselves we'll see where our thinking is taking us away from where it ought to be. We'll see where our life is not producing the fruit it ought to be producing. And we'll use the time that God has given us to give ourselves totally and wholly to his service. Heavenly Father, help us to be real with you this morning. Help us to go out of here to serve you, to bear good fruit, and to be the kind of people that you've dreamt of us being. Because we ask it for your name's sake. Amen.